Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. Until we get a vaccine or a cure for COVID-19, you could argue the most important tool to prevent its deadly spread is data. That is numbers. The data tells us how far apart we should stand, when and where to wear a mask, when we need to shut schools and businesses. To epidemiologists, the numbers are everything. To the rest of us, the numbers are startling, mind-numbing, confusing. Then you add in distrust of the agencies who tally and publish the data to the mix, and well, you have basically where we are today. Today, we'll try to help you make sense of it all, help you understand what you need to know to help stop the spread of this virus. We'll take a look at the government agencies in charge of that data as well. Joining us to start our discussion is Rachel Rubine. She is a health reporter for Politico. Rachel, welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks for having me.
Rachel, let's start with the basics. I kind of alluded to how the numbers are important. Could you expand on that a bit more? Why is the data so important when it comes to fighting an epidemic or a pandemic?
Sure. Well, the data is a really important indicator of how the pandemic is hitting a community. So it helps us know where the hotspots are. It helps public officials, states, journalists to really get a portrait of how severe an outbreak is. And they can also look and see how the state's health system is faring, such as if more hospital beds are needed for patients. Modelers can also use data to make projections about the virus. And, the frequency and accuracy of this data, it's important to note, can have real-life implications, such as how scarce resources are divided up, such as remdesivir, which is among the most promising coronavirus treatments so far.
It's a drug that's being used by physicians. Also, it tells you not only location, but, the age groups, men, women, older, younger, people of color, white people. The data can help identify who's at greater risk and for this disease and especially the serious complications.
It can. All of that data is something that public health officials are watching really closely, and it does help them figure out where resources need to go and see how and where the virus is spreading.
Mm-hmm. Where does the data come from? Who's collecting it? Who's making sense of it? And how are they generating all of these numbers?
Yeah, that's a great question. So in terms, if you look at data that's coming from hospitals, like on ICU beds, on staffing shortages, now that data is coming from the hospital. Officials at the hospitals are the ones who are inputting that data. Sometimes that can be manual entry, and that gets funneled to federal governments and to states. There's also, like you mentioned, a lot of other data on, for example, how many people have positive cases is a number that's looked at really closely. And states do try and put that out on public dashboards for the community to see as well.
It's an incredible task, though. Each state has its own public health department. Those departments collect information from local, city or county health departments. They're collecting it, as you mentioned, from hospitals, doctors' offices. It's an incredibly difficult task. Were we set up to manage this data when this all began?
You're right. It is a lot of data, and there have been existing data systems in place, but those did have to be enhanced. There were new processes that did need to come about in terms of, when we think about just even looking at what exactly, which data are we going to have hospitals report, for example, and that's changed over time, and that's been built on. So it's been really an evolving process.
We're talking with Rachel Rubine. She's a healthcare reporter for Politico here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're trying to make sense of all the COVID-19 data, trying to get to the bottom of it, demystify these numbers, answer your questions about this, and try to help you understand all the numbers that get thrown at you in news reports or if you're on the web checking out various health department sites. If you have a question or a comment, you'd like to join the conversation, especially if you have a question about the data, that's why we're here today, to try to answer some of those questions during this hour. Our phone number is 614-292-8513. Our email is allsides@wosu.org. Of course, you can also reach out to us on our social media channels as well. Rachel, you're our healthcare reporter for Politico. You're deeply immersed in this story, covering it every day, every hour. What numbers do you look at?
One of the numbers that I look at really closely is a site called RT.live. And essentially, those numbers show how fast the virus is growing in each state. So it gives it a score. If the score in a state is above one, then the virus is spreading quickly. If it's below one, then the virus will stop spreading. So for example, I checked today and there are 17 states with numbers that indicate the virus would stop spreading. And that does include Ohio, but this data does change a lot. So that's something that I look at really closely to see and track where different states are in the spread of the virus. I also look...
Rachel, you said Ohio was doing better today than it had been?
Today, if you look at score from RT.live, it has Ohio at 0.96. So score is below virus, below one, the virus will stop spreading. So close to one, but it is a little bit below.
Just barely. So that's a bit of good news. RT.live, who runs this site?
Who runs this site? Check back. I believe, some modelers, but I can get you that exact name in a second.
But they're scientific modelers, and they're analyzing data from around the country and in various states. That's what it comes down to. I think there are so many numbers out there, and I go to the New York Times. They have a big mapping thing. NPR on their website has a big mapping site. The state of Ohio has a site with a dashboard with all kinds of data. It's hard to. Especially in this era of distrusting science among some folks, it's hard to find a place that you trust. Is it not, or is it not that hard, and are we just hearing a lot of noise?
That's a great question. I mean, there are various dashboards. So there's states that put out their public information on, hospitalizations, tests, et cetera. So that's one avenue. There's been a lot of talk about how the federal government is collecting hospital data. There are now some public sites on that. But data accuracy is something that has come up a lot during the coronavirus.
With anything that's new and we don't know a lot about it, the story changes. I mean, we've all heard the stories that early on, Dr. Fauci said, you don't need to wear a mask. But as we've learned, as this thing has progressed, now health officials say the masks do help stop the spread if everyone wears them in particular. So that's just an example of how our knowledge of this virus, our knowledge of this disease has changed. How has the way we look at the data has changed, correct?
As you said, definitely the virus, the science is evolving on the virus. And so we have seen changes as it evolves.
Mm-hmm. Earlier this month, the Trump administration made the decision to change how hospitals and states report the COVID-19 data to the federal government. The data, which had previously gone to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, now is to be reported through the Department of Health and Services. Why the change?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it's important to note you know, how the data was reported previously during the pandemic. Hospitals did have three different options for reporting their coronavirus data. They could report it directly to their state, which would then funnel it to the federal government. They could report to a new portal from an outside vendor that the Department of Health and Human Services had set up, or they could report it to the CDC system. So hospitals did have the option before to do CDC or HHS, but a fair number of hospitals were reporting to the CDC system before the shift because it was familiar to them. It was something that they knew how to use. As for why the change, if you talk to the Department of Health and Human Services, they've maintained that they were building out a new system to try and make it more nimble, that they wanted to streamline the reporting instead of having these different avenues that hospitals could report through. Now I talked to John Auerbach. He's an Obama-era CDC official, and he said that the CDC had wanted for years more money to work on its data system, and he had advocated for that money being sent to the CDC instead of through an outside vendor.
We're talking with Rachel Rubine. She's a health reporter with Politico here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the COVID-19 glut of data and how to make sense of it all. Our phone number is 614-292-8513 if you'd like to join the discussion. Rachel, you mentioned that hospitals had three options to report data. That seems to not make any sense. I mean, they should have to pick one, because otherwise each of those agencies, each of those three different options, is not getting a full picture, correct?
So they did have those three different options, and then they were all kind of being funneled into one system. And so when we talk about the change now, the CDC is not an option for that reporting, and it's all being funneled into one system called HHS Protect.
And of course, the critics say that the ulterior motive is that the Trump administration can better control the information. Do the critics have some merit there? Have you seen any difference since this all began and in the information that you're monitoring every day?
As you mentioned, the issue certainly did attract a lot of political attention. Democrats had accused the administration of seeking to subvert the CDC, and they had accused them of potentially manipulating the data. We've not seen evidence of this. The CDC the CEO of the outside vendor that HHS is using called Teletracking told news outlet MedPage Today last week that they have been seen unequivocally zero efforts by the administration to manipulate the data. HHS has also maintained that CDC still has full access to the data, but there are concerns from Congress and public health experts over whether the change created more burden for hospitals in the middle of the pandemic, and whether hospitals weren't given enough time to make the switch, which could lead to, you know, the data not being as accurate right now as the switch has just recently happened.
Yeah, I mean, I understand wanting to go from three different options down to one, and that makes sense. But switching the system in the middle of a pandemic, I suppose, it is one more thing to worry about for these hospitals. Rachel Rubine, healthy care reporter for Politico. Thanks very much for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher.
Thanks for your time.
We appreciate it. When we come back, we'll talk more about these numbers, try to get a better handle on them. We're talking with two healthcare experts, public health experts, about what they look for. Do they look at hospitalizations? Do they look at cases? Do they look at deaths, ICUs, R-naughts? We'll try to make sense of all the COVID-19 numbers when All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. I'm Mike Thompson.
And I'm Steve Brown, and we are the hosts of Snollygoster, WOSU's podcast all about politics in Ohio.
Each week, we chat about what the shrewd politicians at the State House are up to and how national politics affects us here at home.
Find out why listeners have called us a weekly must-listen. For a lighthearted yet in-depth look at Ohio politics, subscribe to Snollygoster wherever you get your podcasts.
This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We are talking about the COVID-19 pandemic and how to digest all of these numbers.
At the very least, 1% of our population is carrying this virus in Ohio today. We have 11.7 million people, so the math is over 100,000.
That was Dr. Amy Acton back on March 12th at the very start of this pandemic in Ohio. The then Ohio Director of Public Health made that statement, and many people were shocked that the spread of the virus was already so significant. But was it? Today in Ohio, the official estimate for the total number of confirmed or probable cases stands at just about 86,500, still much less than the 100,000 cited in March by Dr. Acton. So was the modeling Dr. Acton used wrong, or are there thousands of people out there walking around with the virus and don't know it? Some health officials around the country worry we are undercounting COVID-19 cases. Joining us now is Eben Kenaw, an associate professor of biostatistics at OSU's College of Public Health. Welcome.
Eben? Thank you.
Hi. And also Dr. Stephen Wolf, a professor of family medicine and population health, and the director of the Virginia Commonwealth University Center on Society and Health. Dr. Wolf, welcome to All Sides.
Good morning.
We are trying to demystify some of these numbers, and these two experts will help us do that. If you'd like to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. Eben, we'll start with you. What numbers do you look at when you're trying to gauge how we're doing against the spread of this virus?
Well, I look at the numbers of cases, the numbers of hospitalizations, the numbers of deaths. I'm on an OSU modeling team that's been working with the Ohio Department of Health. So we have, we have a server where we have some data that's not publicly available. But as far as I can see, the data that we have on that server and the data on the COVID-19 website maintained by ODH are very, very similar.
Mm-hmm. And you've been working with my understanding is the OSU folks and other folks have been working with ODH throughout this pandemic.
That's right.
So let's start with that soundbite we heard of Dr. Acton. I mean, this was the modeling that was this was very early on when, let's put it in context, testing was minuscule. We were doing very little testing. It took us forever to get above 1% of the Ohio population to be tested. So they were using modeling from other pandemics, other viruses, other places around the world to try to get people to understand how widespread this was. But when you look at the number she used, 100,000, and we're still not to that with confirmed or probable cases now when we do have much more testing, where's the disconnect there? Is there a disconnect there, Eben?
I'm not sure that there is a disconnect, and that we know that there are a lot of people who get COVID-19 who don't get symptoms or don't get tested. So, the cases are all people who've been tested. So if you have, let's say that among all people who are infected, only half of them or a third of them are getting tested, then you could easily have a much larger number of infections than you have confirmed or probable cases. We don't really know what the proportion of the Ohio population or the U.S. population is that's been infected.
Let's turn down to Dr. Stephen Wolf from Virginia Commonwealth University. He's the professor of family medicine and population health and the director of the VCU Center on Society and Health. Dr. Wolf, I'll ask you the same question I asked Eben Kenaw. What numbers do you most look at to judge how we are doing against coronavirus?
Well, you mentioned several different measures, the number of cases, hospitalizations, deaths. And those obviously all carry different meaning, and the accuracy does vary. What we've just discussed is that the number of cases is really very dependent on how good a job we're doing with testing. And as Evan said, across the country, we've really fallen short in terms of the adequacy of the testing. So you have to take the case numbers with a grain of salt. They're clearly less than the number of people who are in the population and infected. Many of those people, whether they've been tested or not, may be asymptomatic, carriers, and so forth. So obviously what we're most concerned about are the number that actually develop clinical symptoms and become ill. That's where the hospitalizations get to be more important, because that's telling us people that have reached a severity of illness that they need to be hospitalized. And that can't be, you know, blamed on, you know, testing.
No, that's the hospitalization number was when testing was really lagging here in Ohio. The hospitalization number was, according to the governor and the health director, Amy Acton at the time, that's the number they were looking at to decide when they should reopen. And that was the number that had plateaued back in, you know, in May when they decided to start the reopening. But now we're at 12%, give or take. I haven't checked it in the past day or so, but we're roughly at 12% of Ohio's population has been tested for COVID-19. Dr. Wolf, how is that percentage? Is that a good percentage to give us a good handle on how many people in Ohio have this disease, or is it still pretty low?
Well, it's better than it's been in the past, but, you know, quite honestly, the more important issue, you know, than how well our models work, which are just, you know, our best attempts to forecast, and they always have a certain amount of variation in them, is what do we need to do to prevent these numbers from climbing higher or having a resurgence? And the point I wanted to make about these measures is that they are lagging indicators. So when you see a rise or fall in cases, coming behind that is a change in hospitalizations a couple weeks later, and then after that, an effect on death rates. A lot of our research has been focused on how many Americans are dying from COVID-19, and we're pretty convinced that the number that's being reported is an undercount.
Why do you say that?
Well, the studies that have been done, including ours, show that about two-thirds of excess deaths that are happening during this pandemic are attributed to COVID-19. An additional third are deaths that are attributed to causes other than COVID-19.
Interesting. Eben Kanaugh from Ohio State, also one of the modelers working with the Ohio Department of Health. Right now, the number of deaths in Ohio stands at 3,382. Is that number low, in your opinion, here in the state of Ohio, as the number of people, as it concerns the number of people who have died from this disease?
No, I don't think that number is low, and that's a large fraction of the population of the town in Ohio where I grew up. Mm-hmm. So
you don't think there's been cases, many cases of people who have died that have not been bubbled up into the hospital numbers in the local department?
Oh no, I absolutely agree with Stephen that there are deaths from COVID that are not counted.
I'm not saying 3,000.
Whether I thought that was a low number of deaths, and
no,
I don't.
No, no, absolutely. 3,382 deaths is not a low number by any means. Is it lower than what the real number is the question I was asking you.
Absolutely.
And is there any way, Eben, to get better at that, to get a more realistic, more accurate number on the deaths? How can we do better as a society, as public health agencies?
Well, I think, you know, when you're classifying deaths by causes, it's always a somewhat difficult. You know, it's like many things in public health. It seems simpler than it actually is. And I think a good example is car accidents. Mm-hmm. You know, long ago, in the 20s or 30s, they thought, well, if you were in a car accident, you survived. It was just a miracle. Like the car accident is what kills you. And then later on, when they were doing the research that led to seat belts, it was, you know, the car accident doesn't kill you. It's hitting your head on the steering wheel, or it's being ejected from the vehicle, or something like that. There are additional causes of there's a chain of causes of of death. So, you know, if somebody is killed in a car accident, they've hit their head on the steering wheel. There's no logical contradiction between saying that, you know, they died of a subdural hematoma from hitting their head on the steering wheel, or saying that the car crash killed them. Yeah. And with infectious diseases, it's the same. And if somebody dies of a secondary bacterial infection that they were set up for by a bout with influenza, that doesn't mean that influenza did not kill them.
Yeah. Dr. Wolf, this has been a case with anything. I mean, you could be have a stroke, have lived with a stroke for a year, and then become more susceptible to pneumonia, and that's what eventually leads to the death. But the stroke contributed to the pneumonia. This is not a new issue for epidemiologists and physicians and coroners.
Not a new issue at all, but it's really played out very clearly with COVID-19. The disease, when we first learned about it, was known as largely a respiratory illness. So the majority of people who were succumbing to this disease were experiencing respiratory distress. But we quickly learned that it had other effects on the body. It causes clotting disorders, inflammation of the heart muscle, and even arrhythmias of the heart. So people who appeared to have died of a heart attack, and their death certificate may have indicated so, may have actually had COVID-19 and died of that complication without adequate mention of COVID-19 on the death certificate. In addition to that, there are what we call indirect deaths, which is a great concern that we have, that people with heart disease who never were infected with COVID-19 were unable to receive care. They were scared to call 911 and ended up dying of a heart attack because of delays in receiving care.
Yeah. Dr. Wolf, has the reporting of deaths improved since this began back in February, March? Have physicians, public health officials learned more, and are we getting more accurate numbers now in almost August than we did in March?
It has, especially in the states that were hit hardest first, states like New York and New Jersey. You know, in the first weeks of the pandemic, there was a lot of confusion about how medical examiners should code these deaths, and there was a lot of also difficulty with getting the data reported in quickly. We're still not out of the woods with that. There are major problems with that, especially in certain states. But there has been some improvement and more consistency in how this coding is done. I will add to the point you were asking Evan about, in our research for Ohio, now this is as of June 25th, we estimated that there had been 4,400 excess deaths in Ohio. So that's in excess of the number of COVID-19 deaths. But again, this is a pretty typical pattern across the country where a good deal of additional deaths are occurring because of the pandemic.
Let's go back over that number real quickly, because you said this was late June. So I don't remember exactly where we were in late June. We're probably at least 500 or 600 less than we are now.
It was about 2,500 COVID-19 deaths at the time.
So the state was reporting officially 2,500 confirmed or probable, and you were saying there was more than double that over?
No, about 4,400 was the actual number of excess deaths.
So we're basically the state was reporting half of what you folks were estimating was the real number.
Yeah, 57% basically at that time. But again, this is not unusual, and you know, Evan will back me up on this, I'm sure. In our kind of work, we're not used to seeing mortality data put out this quickly. Normally, there's a year, sometimes 2 years, before the CDC and other health agencies release official mortality data, because it takes time to clean up the coding and you know, make sure you feel good about the quality of the data. And the CDC usually is very reluctant to release provisional data too quickly.
Yeah.
But the pandemic has forced them to rush this out as quickly as possible. So, you know, this kind of open questions that we're talking about is not surprising.
Eben Kana from OSU's College of Public Health. It's messier because we're trying to fight this in real time and not analyze it years, decades later. Is there a danger, Eben, in that? Because, you know, if you hear that there were twice as many deaths as were reported, you're going to distrust the number from the public health officials.
Well, I think the excess deaths, as Stephen explained, and that does include COVID-19 deaths that, mm-hmm. that you know were not detected or not reported as COVID-19 deaths, and also excess deaths from other, you know, that weren't caused by COVID-19 but that are associated with the pandemic, like his example of, you know, somebody who dies of a heart attack because maybe they're afraid to call 911 or something like that.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a reason to, you know, these are issues to be aware of, and you know, as Stephen said, and these are very common issues. I think the effort to get the numbers out very quickly, but to still be careful about it is admirable. And the fact that not, you know, it would be shocking if every single COVID death actually made it into this system the first time around when things are happening so quickly. So I would, you know, it's not a, you know, nobody's trying to be, it's not a sign of dishonesty or incompetence. It's just that this is an inherently difficult thing to do.
Yes, this is something that usually, as Dr. Wolf mentioned, you'll take a year to really get a accurate understanding of what happened. And because we're trying to fight this in real time and prevent other people from getting sick and raise public awareness and get people to wear masks and guide public officials on when and how long to shut down things, that it's a messy process, but it almost has to
right be. And it often takes longer than a year.
Yeah.
You know, it's often 2 or 3 years before you know official estimates of influenza disease burden are solidified.
I was just reading a book about the influenza from 1918, and it was decades later they were figuring out what was going on, thanks to some DNA testing and things like that. And we Americans, I think it's particular, maybe just humans in general, want quick answers right away, and it doesn't always work that way. Let's get to the phones and get some of the listener calls and questions here. And we'll go from Bob from Pataskala. You're on the air on 89.7 NPR News.
Hey, thanks for the call. Something that I come across or just listening to other radio shows and actually have folks tell me, and again, I'm not quite sure, you know, the accuracy of it and or if it makes any sense, is that if you're tested and you come in positive, it counts as a positive. If you're tested the next day, it's reported as a second positive, like in a sense. So if you're tested positive and like 10 days in a row or 9 days, if you're hospitalized, it comes back as reported as 9 positives. But if you test negative, it's only reported.
Okay.
Is that?
Yeah. Let's get an answer to that question. Are multiple tests on the same person counted as individual tests in the data? Evan, can you answer that one?
It would be counted as one case of COVID.
Okay.
But yeah, it wouldn't be counted as 9 cases of COVID.
Okay. So So the fact that you were tested twice and tested positive twice, it would still be just one case, not 2 cases.
Yeah, and I believe I've seen people tested up to 40 times, mm-hmm. but that's, you know, in the data that we have on the server, but it's only one case.
Now on the
no
test,
matter how many times they get tested.
When you look at the Ohio dashboard at the Ohio Department of Health site, it has the number of tests. Are those tests representative of individuals, or are they representative of tests which might include an individual getting tested more than once?
I don't know the answer to that question.
Okay. Dr. Wolf, do you know what the practice is around the country when it comes to reporting tests? Is that just the raw number of tests? And if someone's tested several times, it's going to show up, it's going to tick that number up?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with your dashboard, but if it's like most, it's counting the number of people who have been tested, not the number of tests that have been administered. You know, the important question from a public health standpoint is how many people have been tested. You know, the number of tests per individual depends on circumstances. You know, for screening, it might just be one test, but you know, it's very common for people who are in the hospital to be tested multiple times and so forth.
Yeah, you know, employers have rules. I mean, look at Major League Baseball. If you test positive, you got to test negative, I think, twice. So that you know, is one example of how folks might be tested more than one time to rejoin the workforce or rejoin their activities. We're talking about the COVID.
Well, and I did see people, like in the Ohio data, there are people who are tested multiple times, but the vast majority of people in that data set are tested once.
So it's a pretty good number to look at. And when you see that 12 to 13% of the population of Ohio has been tested, that's a pretty good assessment of how widespread our testing is. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about COVID-19, the numbers, trying to digest the numbers, make sense of all of the numbers we are getting every day. Which ones are most important? Which ones can we really use to gauge how we're doing in the fight against COVID-19? When All Sides continues here on 89.7 NPR News. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Mike Thompson sitting in for Ann today. We're trying to demystify all of the data that we're hearing and seeing with regards to the COVID-19 pandemic. Our guests, Eben Kanaw, an associate professor of biostatistics at Ohio State University's College of Public Health, and also Dr. Stephen Wolf. He's a professor of family medicine and population health and director of the Virginia Commonwealth University Center on Society and Health. If you have a question or comment about all the numbers, all the data you're hearing about COVID-19, give us a call, 292, area code 614-292-8513. Dr. Wolf, you mentioned your focus, a lot of your focus right now is on looking at the deaths. Have we gotten better? Have doctors gotten better at treating this disease since this all began? And that hopefully has reduced the number of folks who die from it?
I think so. I mean, there's definite progress that's been made in treating this disease, both in having some consistent guidelines and protocols that doctors across the country are using, and, you know, drugs like remdesivir and others that help reduce the severity of the illness. So, yeah, that's certainly been very helpful in reducing case fatality from this disease. But the most important measures are really public health measures. The other thing I just want to throw out there for us to come back to is, as a doctor, I would say that mortality is just one metric, mm-hmm. and obviously the most severe, but it's the tip of the iceberg, because under that is a lot of what we would call morbidity, people who aren't dying but are suffering health complications that in some cases can last with them for years.
Yeah, we're hearing about cardiovascular issues and things like that we're just now starting to learn about.
Right. The neurologic complications, but also these people that I referred to earlier, the indirect mortality cases. Imagine you're a person who's developing the warning signs of stroke, and you're scared to call 911, and minutes matter.
Yes.
In a stroke. You may get to the hospital, you may survive, but you may end up with a neurologic deficit that you're left with the rest of your life because of that delay.
All right. Let's go to the phones. John in Columbus, you have a question for our guest here on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Go ahead, John.
I hear people wanting to compare this to the flu, and so you've raised about a dozen different questions or complications here in how we even look at the data. So can you give us some kind of indication? Is this worse or better? Well, I don't know. That's a strange word. Is this worse than the flu?
Eben Kanaw from OSU, why don't you take that one? Thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think this is an interesting question. And this is absolutely worse than seasonal flu. You know, this has already killed more Americans than World War I did, and it's taken 6 months to do it instead of, you know, the 2 or 3 years that America was involved in World War I. So this is bad.
Yeah.
But trying to reassure ourselves by comparing it to flu gets infectious disease epidemiology almost perfectly backwards. Influenza is the apex predator of infectious diseases. And, you know, we get accustomed to it because it comes around every year, but it's like living with a pet tiger. It's like living with a playful and angry pet tiger. And if any of us are going to die of an infectious disease, that infectious disease is probably going to be flu. And if any disease brings civilization to its knees, it's very likely to be flu. You know, the Spanish influenza took 3 years to kill more people. You know, it killed in 3 years, you know, 1.5 or 2 times as many people as World War II killed in 6 years.
Yeah.
So, you know, the comparison to influenza is, you know, is not a useful one, I think, because people really, you know, it really is showing us that we ought to take influenza more seriously than we do. I'm personally terrified of influenza, you know, based on my experience in infectious disease epidemiology.
So I know you don't want to compare it, but if influenza is that apex predator, that tiger that's lurking, what would a coronavirus, which is more similar to a common cold, what would that, what kind of animal would that be, to use the metaphor again?
No, the point is that, you know, as far as our response to this pandemic, why is the comparison relevant?
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand the relevance of the comparison in terms of making decisions about what we're going to do with this thing now.
Yeah, I think the comparison started with, because we haven't dealt with a coronavirus, at least not in recent memory, to this scale. We have dealt with H1N1. We've dealt with other flu pandemics or epidemics that have sprung up. You know, Dr. Wolf, can you see where the comparison began? It certainly is. It's not the flu. It's a different virus, but it's like the virus, like the flu. It does spread through similar contacts.
Yeah, I really would work against comparing this to a common cold.
Okay.
There are obviously some proportion of people who get through this with nothing more severe than that, but. The lethality of this disease, both in terms of the mortality that we've talked about and the long-term complications, is nothing like what we would expect from a typical winter cold. I think, you know, what we're trying to get at here is the larger issue is how well prepared is our society to deal with mutated viruses and other organisms that can cause a pandemic.
Mm-hmm.
This pandemic was warned about years ago. And there were instructions and guidelines and urgent recommendations of how to prepare the country for it. Those were largely ignored, and funding for public health agencies was cut. I'm hoping from this we learn the error of our ways and start reordering our priorities, because there will be other pandemics to come. COVID-19 is not the last one we'll be facing. And the larger issue is regrouping so that our country is better prepared for situations like this.
We're talking about COVID-19 and the data, trying to digest the data, figure out which numbers we should pay attention to, which numbers we should perhaps put aside. Should we compare this to the flu? Apparently, we should not. We shouldn't compare it to anything except perhaps COVID-19 and how we handle it right now. Our guest you just heard, Dr. Stephen Wolf from Virginia Commonwealth University's Center on Society and Health. And also with us is Eben Kanah, an associate professor of biostats at OSU's College of Public Health. Another number that, let's look at the media. I mean, let me look at myself and how we report this. We only have, in radio, we have, you know, seconds. We have maybe a minute, maybe 3 minutes. This conversation's a bit longer. So we have to quickly get the information to the listener, to our viewers, to our readers about where we stand on the virus. Eben, how do you think the media is doing in reporting the numbers and also accurately portraying the nuance behind those numbers? Eben,
you know,
go ahead.
Yeah, no, I'm, you know, as someone who's familiar with a lot of the nuances, it's sometimes disappointing to see, you know, coverage of these issues in the media. But I think, you know, people are honestly attempting to grapple with what is a much more difficult issue than it appears to be. initially. And I think there is a severe problem with innumeracy in our society and in the media, and that this is one of the situations where that rears its head. People are not good at thinking about risk, and they're not good at thinking about probabilities or conditional probabilities, and those are the basic skills that you need in order to understand and interpret the numbers. But I don't think the media is doing a bad job. Certainly not intentionally.
You could say if we are. It's okay. We won't take offense. Dr. Stephen Wolf, I know you have to leave us in a couple of minutes. You have another commitment. But how can we do better as reporters the whole thing about how deaths, we're not going to know the true death number for years, but yet we're reporting deaths every day. Is that a good use of our time here in the media?
I think the media has done a pretty good job. I agree with Evan that there are some nuances that get missed sometimes because case numbers plateau. The media are too quick to say we're out of the woods, not remembering that this is a lagging indicator and more trouble is coming down the road. But the bigger issue for me is the polarization of our media. So there are, those information bubbles, and there is a sector of our population that is listening to different media and getting very skewed and distorted information, which, in the normal realm of politics is, goes with the territory. But here there's a life and death consequence when certain public health measures are portrayed as a conspiracy or a political maneuver and people's health is at stake.
Dr. Stephen Wolf, professor of family medicine and population health and director of the Virginia Commonwealth University Center on Society and Health. Thanks for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Evan Knaugh from Ohio State University's College of Public Health stays with us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're trying to digest the numbers here of the COVID-19. Evan, let's start with what Dr. Wolf just said. In your work, you're working on this every day, looking at these stats every day, trying to portray accurately what's going on and get a clear message out to folks what they need to do to prevent the spread. How hard is it to do that in this atmosphere that we find ourselves in right now with the polarized media and social media and rumors on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram?
That's been the most unedifying part of working in this pandemic right now. I guess the thing is not like a lot of times this issue is portrayed as questioning science, and science is designed to be questioned. Honest inquiry is what makes science work. I think the issue to me is really arrogance in the face of nature. When a problem of this magnitude is wished away or ignored. And, I think in many cases, people kill each other more effectively through incompetence or ignorance than they do with bullets or bombs. Mm-hmm. And, infectious disease epidemiology, infectious diseases are one way that it happens. They're not the only way. Watching the way Amy Acton was treated was infuriating. And, this is not something we can pretend our way out of or bloviate our way out of. Mm-hmm. And we have to face the problem like responsible adults and take care of it. And it can be done. And I think the Navajo Nation had a severe problem with COVID, and they turned it around. So that shows what Americans can do if they take the problem seriously.
Evan Knaugh is associate professor of biostats at Ohio State University's College of Public Health. Just about a minute left, Evan. As we look to the late summer, fall, and we fear another wave, a real second wave, what's the number one number we should look at? Is cases okay to look at now? Do we have enough testing to say that, okay, cases is a good number, or should we still look at hospitalizations? Is deaths the number to look at?
Well, the thing with deaths and hospitalizations, and as Stephen mentioned, is that they're lagging indicators.
Yeah.
So one of the things people have been trying to dismiss case numbers by saying that hospitalizations and deaths have not gone up, but it's following essentially the same pattern it did back in March.
But case numbers, are you confident enough, because we are now testing 12-13%, and it will increase even more as the months go on, hopefully, that the case number is a number we can look at and have some faith that that's accurately showing how prevalent the disease is?
No, the case number is not showing
not
how
yet.
Prevalent
okay.
the disease is.
All right, so we still should look at hospitalizations.
You know, we have tested 12 or 13%. We're not, and the better thing to do would be if we could test a random sample of the population.
Yeah.
And there's been an attempt to do that, and it was pushed back.
We got to leave it there. Eben Kana, Associate Professor of Biostats at OSU's College of Public Health. Thanks for joining us here on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Stay with 89.7 NPR News. We'll try to help you understand these numbers in the days, weeks, and months ahead. I'm Mike Thompson on 89.7 NPR News.